Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. Hey, it's 4th of July today. So I hope you're relaxing and enjoying this Independence Day. Kind of apropos, as you know, last week, Scott Walter on the American Unearthed talked about our founding fathers, their Mason background, and the sacredness of our country. And today is a time to think about that, to think about what they came over here to do, and what makes America special to you. It's funny, I've traveled through Europe and done a lot of travel through Central America, and you know, you just don't know how great our country is until you go to other countries. Each country has its own personality, and I personally really have a great love for Mexico, even though it's challenged in its administration, its government, and country is very poor, but it has a real charm to it that I really love. But America is a really amazing place, and today is a time to think about that. So I hope you will, as you're celebrating, shooting your fireworks, having the craft beer, and enjoying a hot dog. So happy 4th of July. I want to highlight some of the things that happened this past week. I have been posting photographs from the surface of Mars, and I don't want Earth Ancients to become a Mars-centric kind of focus group and program, but Mars continues to fascinate me, and I posted a series of photographs just a couple of days ago on some of the surface features, excuse me, and actually, under the weekly Mars image, there is a photo that came up just a few days ago of what looks like, and it's very definitive in its shape, what looks like part of an underground canal system that has been pushed to the surface. Now, no one knows actually how big it is. Some people say it's an actual building. But what did come up in a number of analyses is that this is it's intelligently designed and engineered. Actually, it was posted June 30th, but it's been re-examined a number of times by a number of people that have quality imaging technology, and this photo actually shows what looked like concrete slabs and a structure. Now it may be very small. It may be, and it's a close up. The photo is a close up of this. It may be the remains of a piping system, an underground piping system, or maybe it was on the surface and it's just been broken. But one of the most fascinating parts of this image is that the angular construction, or how it was poured into a mold or constructed just on the surface, is so artificial. It's just amazing. And there's nothing anyone can say. And I would love for a representative from NASA or the guys that are working the rover that took the picture out in Pasadena at JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab, to really say something about this. It's really hard. And I think many of the comments about the photographs were that, you know, the Americans won't fess up. Maybe we got to get the Russians. And the Russians have sent satellites to Mars. But maybe somebody with deep pockets like China needs to take a look at it and really divulge some of these anomalies on the surface of the planet. But what came out on this photo was that as you pull back from this small canal, the small structure that is very square and geometric in shape and it looks like concrete, is that scattered around it are a number of sculptures. There have been other sculptures featured around Cydonia, the region where the face on Mars is. And these sculptures are distinct. And I posted some photos just a couple of days ago on the Facebook Earth Ancients group page. You got to go to the group page. And the sculptures are just amazing. And some of them are very distinct with helmets, face wear, and distinct symbology on their chest. So I just don't know how NASA and JPL can continue to say that there is nothing man artificial on the planet. The follow-up to that segment is another series of photographs of massive surface reliefs, and these include heads of people or humanoids. There's the most famous one is this bald head individual. Some people call it JPL or Lyndon B. Johnson because he has a big ear. And there's a number of other animals and birds and people that are put together in this compilation that you can find on Earth Ancients Facebook page under Mars. And these are fairly substantial images. As an artist, as a someone who studied engineering and architecture, these are not simple flashes of light. They are artificially created on a massive scale. Some of them are half a mile across, and were made to be seen from above the ground. So the beings that posted this, and by the way, the series of photos I'm talking about, the title is Ancient Mars, and it was posted just a couple of days ago, July 2nd, and basically the first paragraph reads here. It's, we now have verifiable evidence that Mars was once inhabited over 1 million years ago by a sophisticated civilization. To date, NASA has decided not to reveal details on the huge amounts of standing archaeology that litters the surface of the planet, but has ceased covering up the data. And I'll let you read the rest of it. Now, we know that because Dr. John Brandenburg has revealed to us that he's of the understanding, and there's other scientists, space scientists that he's spoken with and have talked to him about this, that NASA is not covering it up anymore. It's JPL. JPL, who runs the rovers, is selecting what people see. But just because there's so much surface archaeology, they can't cover it all up. So people are catching it, like what we see in these groups of photographs. So take a look at it. It's kind of a cool opportunity to see some real outstanding archaeology and surface reliefs, artistic reliefs on a massive scale. And let's just cross our fingers that our government will one day soon just say, hey, we have found evidence of a civilization on the surface. So we can only cross our fingers that time will come soon. So that is on the Facebook page. So, hey, you guys probably remember, I think it was about a month and a half ago, when my guest was Dr. Danny Nadawig-Jaja, who is the geologist and the responsible archaeologist who's excavating the Indonesian pyramid known as Gunung Penang. And one of the real interesting features of this was that, first of all, Dr. Danny was telling us that every bit of research was verified, and they were doing pretty substantial C14 or age testing, carbon dating. And what made this ancient ruin, this pyramid, quite unique was they were getting dates back as far back as 20,000 years ago. I think one of the dates was 28,000 years ago. And the engineering prowess involved in this, in the design of this pyramid, included various rooms, various levels that have been built up over thousands and thousands of years. And I even believe he had discussed that they had used certain equipment that could measure certain types of radiation that were coming out of the center of the building, the pyramid. And Danny wrote a book and felt that it was potentially part of much older civilization in the Pacific. And what we do know is, and what we've heard about, and we've heard about it from people like Colonel James Churchward in his books on Lemuria or Mu, is that there was apparently a sophisticated culture that lived in the Pacific on this massive continent. And over a period of time, the landmass was destroyed by various tectonic shifts that basically collapsed it. But there really hasn't been, other than Churchward's work, any really solid material or new books on Mu. And this is why my guest today is presenting some very, very interesting research on what he has discovered. Now, my guest today is George Schwimmer. He was a theater director for 30 years, as well as teaching theater at two colleges and a university. He later studied film at UCLA Extension and was a VP of development for a Los Angeles TV station. After he did that, for the next 35 years, he studied and practiced life therapy, spirit releasement, Reiki, past life readings, and shamanic healings. And he's going to tell us a little bit about his shamanic work. But I think the unique part of what George brings to the plate on Mu is that he believes that this is quite verifiable on a number of levels. And we're going to hear about what he has discovered. George, welcome to the program. How are you today?
Thank you, Cliff. Good to be with you.
Yeah. So the complete title of this work that you've done is Mu, the the first great civilization and its connection to Peru, New Mexico, the Hopi, and the Santa Fe. And Santa Fe, can you, I mean, first of all, I mean, we talked a little bit before the show. Why should we be interested in a lost continent that is 20, 30, 40, 100,000 years old? Is there some connection that we need to be interested in?
Well, and that's sort of an interesting question after you just got through talking about the ancient civilizations on Mars. I think the main reason is that for some probably political reason, it's the best word I can think of, the establishments around the world for the last several thousand years have been suppressing information. I don't know why they've been doing that. The only thing I can figure out is that it came out of the various religions, which were, of course, invented, and the priests in these religions used the suppression of information to control the people who they wanted to control. And that's the only thing I can think of, because it is bizarre how scientists keep misrepresenting the history of the Earth and keep ignoring and suppressing information that is factual. It's not even theoretical. It is factual. So I can't really tell you why this has taken place. With my background, though, you were talking about the 4th of July, and that sort of sparked something in my head that I hadn't thought about before. And both Mu and Atlantis not only collapsed physically, geologically, and went into the ocean, but they the civilizations collapsed because the people who were ruling these and running these countries kept becoming more and more corrupt and greedy and power hungry. And when I think about that, and I think about the present political and economic situation in the United States, it gives me a little bit of a worry, because this is the kind of progression that took place in both Atlantis and Mu, where the spiritual aspect of the countries were eroded, and after a while the only thing people cared about was money and power. And it seems to me that that's the same sort of thing that's happening in the United States right now. And the other thing that sparked in my head when you were talking about the 4th of July was that from a spiritual point of view, it's very possible. A lot of people have said that the United States is a spiritual experiment. And this spiritual experiment could be a sort of a replaying of what should have happened with the societies of Mu and Atlantis, but didn't. And so, you know, we have to be hopeful that we're not going to wind up the same way as Mu and Atlantis did.
That's fascinating thought. I think I remember reading a passage from Edgar Casey's book that there was two factions in Atlantis that fought constantly, and one was a very highly spiritual group, and another one was maybe more focused on the material wealth of the times, and it was an ultimate demise of the country.
Yeah, that is correct. The technologists won. I had an interesting experience with that. Just to mention this quickly, when I was doing past life therapy, I had a client who lived in Atlantis when it was in its final stages of destruction, and she described exactly what you just said, that there were two groups of people, one spiritually oriented and the others who were scientific and apparently very stubborn. And eventually she and a lot of the other spiritual people left. And Atlantis, the last of Atlantis, was destroyed by the scientists and military by their misuse of lasers.
Wow. let's talk a little bit about this wonderful book that you wrote. In the introduction of the book, you describe your shamanic initiation into the, Kero?
Yeah, you pronounce it K-E-R-O.
Okay, K-E-R-O. Kero shamanic rites of passage. And that you said that this was the trigger point in the beginning of your interest in the discovery and the background of Mu. What did the shaman of the Peru area where you received your initiation tell you about Mu? Was there some form of history that was presented, or was it more that the rituals were tens of thousands of years old and that was the trigger point?
Nobody ever talked about Mu, which is kind of interesting. But I was given these, part of the training was getting these nine sacred rites, and they're not just symbolic. They have very practical purposes, which I won't get into because it's too long a story. But after I got these rites, which some of them were really magical, our lead instructor, Dr. Alberto Violdo, who's been working and studying with the Kero shamans for close to 30 years now, he's an anthropologist. And he said he thought these rites went back under 100,000 years. And I thought, 100,000 years? Where did that come from? And that just kept bugging me, you know. And I started these studies back in 2005. And for the next 5 to 7 or 8 years, this question kept periodically coming up in my mind, and I kept thinking, where in God's name could these have come from? What existed? What human civilization existed 100,000 years ago? I didn't know of anything except Atlantis. And I remembered also that there had been this continent of and civilization of what most people call Lemuria, except I'd never read anything about it. It was just mentions in one book or another, one esoteric book or another. Then I recalled that Edgar Cayce had a handful of readings that mentioned people from Lemuria or Mu. And then in the back of my head, I suddenly remembered years and years ago, I had run across a mention of a Colonel James Churchward, who had written 5 books. I didn't know it was 5 books then, but had written about Mu. And so I went online and I went to Amazon, and sure enough, there was James Churchward. And he had written 5 books on Mu. And I found offer where they offered 5 copies of paperbacks of his books, and I bought those and I read them, and it just sort of you know lit up this bulb in my head, and I thought, oh, okay. And the immediate connection that I made was that Mu was a very spiritual society. And a great many, and probably most of the ruins that are attributed to Mu or to people who went to other parts of the world, their buildings were temples. So, which tells us, you know, that they were very spiritual. Well, this connects with my Kero shamans. Now, everybody thinks that the Kero are descendants of the Inca, but they're not. In fact, most of the Inca Empire, for most people who have read this already know, most of the people in the Inca Empire weren't Inca. The Inca conquered neighboring tribes and civilizations and cities and whatever, and either conquered them militarily or peacefully incorporated them into their empire. And so the ancestors of the Kero shamans were called Laika, L-A-I-K-A. And that means, what's the word now? Keepers of wisdom.
Okay.
And so I made this connection between the Laika and Mu. This was just an intellectual connection. I had nothing to base it on. But I decided I'm going to go online and I'm going to go down to Amazon and see if I can find any books about Mu. Well, as you point out, there has been very little written about Moo as a entire book, but there are books that have chapters that deal with aspects of Moo. And what I found interesting about that is that almost all of these books have been published since 2000. James Churchward published his book on Moo in 1928, and then he published his other books in the next two or three years, and virtually nothing was written for the next 70 years. And all of a sudden now, people are writing about Moo since the turn of the century. So that's
why do you think that is? Why would you think that starting in 2000, this would be a resurgence of interest in Moo?
I can only say it comes from a spiritual aspect, because why did I get interested in Moo? I had no reason to. I had absolutely no reason to get interested in Moo. I've spent a great 35 years of my life involved in all kinds of other metaphysical things, and I knew nothing about Moo and had no interest in shamanism. I had no interest in Moo. All of a sudden, I'm interested in shamanism. All of a sudden, I get interested in finding out, you know, what the origins of this are and of Mu are. I don't know. It's a spiritual thing, and I can't really explain it to you completely. I can give you a couple of guesses. I give you some guesses, but that's all I can do.
Okay. So, George, let's help our audience, those of who don't know about Lemuria or Mu. Can you give us a little primer? Where was Mu? What is just a little historic overview would be great before we dive into to some details.
According to Churchward, let me just mention something about James Churchward. He was a military man in the British Army. He was sent to India, I guess it was somewhere around in the 1870s, and he apparently had some time on his hands, and he got interested in temple carvings and what the symbols meant. And he met a priest at one of these temples, and the priest noticed that Churchward was interested in these symbols, and so he started tutoring Churchward about the symbols and what they meant and so on. And in the course of that, he mentioned that in the temple there were these ancient tablets that went way back in time. And of course, Churchward got very interested immediately, and the priests refused to show them to him. And Churchward kept on coming up with different ploys to get the priest to show him the tablets. And finally, the priest said, okay, I'll show you a couple. And so he brought a couple out from storage to somewhere deep under the temple and read the inscriptions. This man knew how to read these inscriptions on these tablets. And not only did Churchward get fascinated, but the priest got fascinated. So then they went and unpacked all of these tablets over a period, I guess, of months or maybe even longer. And this is where all his information came from. Okay, so that's the background. Now, people discount, the scientific community discounts Churchward because he didn't footnote his books. And he refused to say where the temple was located because the priest was afraid that if the location were revealed, then people would come and steal them or destroy them or whatever, which had been done before at other temples. So Churchward couldn't, make himself believable to the scientific community. Although if you read his books, it's very obvious that, you know, he's not making this stuff up. So anyway, according to him, the continent of Mu was a huge continent. I forget the exact amount of miles. It was something like 5,000 by 3,000 miles, I think is what he said. And it was not totally connected. There were three segments, and the three segments were separated by some bit of water, apparently not a great deal. But anyway, they're separated a little bit by water, so it wasn't one solid continent. There were three segments to this continent. According to these tablets, the population was about 64 million people. And apparently the continent went, let's put it this way, the civilization of Mu went back about 200,000 years. He didn't get into, and I don't think anybody can even guess at this point, what went before you know, to create this civilization or how it started. But he said that his feeling was that, you know, the biblical Garden of Eden actually was on the continent of Mu. And he didn't say, you know, a man was created on the continent of Mu, but that's what he mentioned. So anyway, so there was these 64 million people over, you know, these many millennia. And eventually, as the population grew, either because the population was getting a little bit big or because people were just adventurous, some people started going out to other parts of the world. And eventually they created different societies like Atlantis and India and Indonesia and Japan and so on. And so if you look at the world map, you see, okay, Mu is in the middle of the Pacific, and people went both east and west.
Right.
Okay, now...
let me just interrupt you real quickly. One of the things that you bring up that I have known about, and our audience probably doesn't know, but there's a very, very ancient Hindu text called the Rig Vedas, and they give reference to... the great civilization. Now, they don't say Mu, but they do give reference to a great civilization that's thousands and thousands of years old. And I think the audience needs to understand just how old Mu was and why in your book you call it the first great civilization. We're talking tens of thousands of years ago, very, very, very ancient. What, maybe 100,000 years or older, right?
Yeah. I don't know if, you know, they started, Churchward didn't say when they started moving out of Mu to other countries, but in reference to that document from India, it states that it was a huge continent to the east of India, which puts it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and it says they were worshippers of the sun, which is not true, but everybody thinks we can get into the symbology of that, but the symbol of the sun was very important to Mu, so maybe that's why they call them sun worshippers. But Churchill says they were not sun worshippers. The sun was simply a symbol of Mu and a symbol of the creator. And according to that Indian document, that continent was destroyed by volcanoes and tidal waves and left only Indonesia and the Pacific Islands, which is exactly what happened. So although they don't call it Mu, in every other respect, the Indian document is correct.
Okay.
And one of the more interesting things, it's just sort of a sidelight, but it's interesting all the same, particularly with you talking about a civilization on Mars. You know, everybody has this pride in modern civilization that we're the technological civilization. Well, the records or stories or legends of Atlantis and Mu both indicate that both the people of Mu and the people of Atlantis had flying machines of one kind or another. And Indian documents also indicate that in the far history of India, they had flying machines. So that's sort of interesting there also.
That is, yeah. Do we have a sense of the consciousness that they brought to, say, Mexico or the present, or what was known as Atlantis or other places? I mean, you talk about them as a peaceful, highly spiritual group. Obviously, they had technology if they had flying machines. But is there something about them that is like a trademark to Mu in terms of their level of consciousness and what they leave to these other parts of the world that you discovered?
Yeah, you have to put it into the context of time and of what happened to Mu. Now, I don't know what they did when they first came here. Or other places. But Mu was destroyed in three epochs. One was around 50,000 BC. The first segment went under the ocean. Second segment went under the ocean around 26 or 28,000 BC, something like that. And the third one, immersion and the final destruction of Mu came around 11,000 BC. Now, obviously, after the first destruction and inundation, the people of Mu had to have known that they were living on a unstable continent and that they were living on borrowed time, although it was many thousands of years. But in any case, they started apparently emigrating at a greater rate. And when they came to the various places, and I did not try to find out about places like India or Indonesia, but I was focused on the west coast of North and South America and along that arc. They built huge cities, huge temples, massive temples, and these all reflected the spiritual nature of the people, because everywhere, and there are, you know, archaeologists claim that we haven't even found all the different cities or temples or whatever in South America, because the jungles of South America are so dense that you can't even get through. So there are still temples and cities to be found somewhere, and they're all similar. So, you know, the idea of a pyramid, you know, if you say pyramid, most people think of, you know, Egypt, but there are pyramids all over the world, including Europe. And even in the United States, there were some so-called pyramids that were made out of dirt. So, you know, there is a structure that is similar all around the world, and these are all temples. As I say, you know, huge cities which indicate a great technological expertise by the people who built them. Okay. For example, in all of these places, the stones are cut so exactly that you can't hardly put a hair between them. They are fitted so closely, and nobody can figure out how it was done. It couldn't have been done, you know, with chisels and things like that. And, you know, I can only guess that somewhere back then they had some technology, and maybe like lasers or whatever, but nobody can figure out how they were built. They had such a high technology. And this
So you're saying that they were megalithic builders. They built in stone and in rock. And
huge.
So would you say that maybe Cusco and Sacsayhuaman are remnants of Mu's civilization, because they are exactly what you're talking about, extreme precision in megalithic stonework.
Right. The next thing I discovered when I made this connection, I started going on the internet, and I found legends. And these legends I found in various places. So I'm assuming that they are basically oral history. They may not be 100% accurate, but they present a continuing similar picture. The one I want to focus on is Tiwanaku. Tiwanaku? I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it.
Tiwanaku.
And apparently, at one time, Tiwanaku was at sea level. It is now at 12,500 feet. Now, how in God's name does, you know, something go from sea level to 12,500 feet? And according to Churchward, and this is, Churchward had a great habit in his writing of making fun of scientists. And one of the things that he insisted on in his books was that the mountains in North and South America and the rest of the world did not exist before about 17,000 BC. According to geologists, it was millions of years ago, and Churchward says nonsense. They came up about 17,000 years ago. Well, that certainly explains why Lake Titicaca is at 12,500 feet, because it came up with the mountains along the western edge of North and South America. And that was Churchward's theory about it. So the legends say that a man named Amaru Muru, a very high-ranking individual in the Mu society, was sent after the first part of Mu sank into the ocean to create cities, and other people were sent to create cities to what we now know as South America. But this guy in particular was sent to the area which is now Peru, and when he got there, according to legend, he arrived at the what were already islands in Lake Titicaca, which means that the first inundation had already happened, because prior mm-hmm. to that, there had been a huge city, which the Hopi write about, or speak about, at the bottom of Lake Titicaca. The city was named Titicaca originally, and when the inundation came, it became a lake, and the whole city of Titicaca is at the bottom of Lake Titicaca right now. And they have found some ruins. They have found some ruins at the bottom of the lake. So this man apparently came and he created this all these megaliths that you mentioned. And they were the predecessors of the Inca. And then later in time, the Inca incorporated the, when they conquered that part of South America, they incorporated these immigrants from Mu, and originally the people of Mu called themselves children of the sun, and the emperor or king or priest, king priest of Mu was called Ra Mu, and Ra meant sun. And so this is where the symbol of the sun comes in for Mu. And so the Inca claimed them the title of Children of the Sun for themselves, and everybody thinks that this came from the Inca, but it didn't. It came from Mu. The Inca Empire only lasted for about 250 years. I think it was something like 1300 to 1533. And so that is a background of, you know, where it came. It came from Mu to the western coast of Peru, Lake Titicaca, and then eventually wound up with the Inca in Cusco.
Let me ask you a question, and this is fascinating. There's a number of research scientists that are in Peru who have discovered anomalous skeletal remains, and I think the most typically recognizable type of human is this long-headed, very, very long-headed human. Yeah. Would you say that those are people from the sun culture of Mu that you're talking about, or are those just an anomalies? Because there's so many of these individuals, and unfortunately, we haven't had a real solid analysis of their of skeletal remains other than the cranium. And their brain capacity seems to be between 25% and 30% larger than what we have today. So, do you have anything to say about that regarding those remains?
Yeah, I believe that those are probably extraterrestrials, and I'll tell you why. There was, first of all, a book written, which is in my book, by a Hopi elder, and he recounted the far ancient history of the Hopi, and he said that the Hopi originally came from Mu. And along with that, he said when these cataclysms started happening, he said extraterrestrials came and helped his people when they got to South America, and helped them to migrate to Central America, Mexico, and then North America. Mm-hmm. Now, the same legend exists in Hawaii. The native Hawaiians also state that Hawaii was once part of Mu, and that extraterrestrials had helped their people when Mu got into the straits that it got into at this time. Now, and third, the lady who I mentioned, who I regressed a number of years ago back to Atlantis, also mentioned that in Atlantis, extraterrestrials had been helping the people, and that in her past life recall, she also mentioned that she was taken by some type of flying machine out of Atlantis and flown to Egypt, where a lot of the immigrants from Atlantis went. And this is what created the sudden explosion of culture and so on and so forth in Egypt, was the influx of all these intelligent and educated people from Atlantis. So it is quite possible that those skeletons that you're talking about are extraterrestrials.
Okay. In your book, you mention that the land of Lemuria, or Mu, had pretty much all the cultures that we see today, the red culture, the yellow, the white. I think the five cultures of the world were there? Is that what you had discovered?
No, well, I didn't write about cultures, but all five races were, according to Church Word, all five races were on and in the continent and civilization of Mu. And what's interesting about that, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's surprising or not, but in any case, what is surprising and interesting is that when people came and rediscovered Easter Island, they found three races of people there. And one was white-skinned, one was brown-skinned, and one was black-skinned. And Easter Island is only about 7.5 miles by, I don't know, 10 miles or something like that. I mean, it's not a very big island. And how could you have three races on this tiny island? And so it's very obvious that you had, you know, these people were remnants of the population of Mu that Churchward wrote about.
It's fantastic to comprehend, because there are civilizations, and as an example, I've done a lot of research in Central America, and here's the Olmec civilization that comes out of nowhere, completely settled, sophisticated engineering artistically, and there's these gigantic basalt stone African-looking figures, as well as Caucasian, and quite a few Asiatic looking individuals. So it's a real mix that just shows up. And these are not, I mean, it's very hard for scientists to discover a starting point. They just arrive. And it's like they just showed up from some other place.
They did. They did. You mentioned Mexico, and Mexico was the last thing that I discovered. I didn't really think about Mexico when I was doing my research. I was mainly focused on North America and Peru and the Pacific Rim. And then I ran across something in Churchward that I'd forgotten about, and he has a diagram in one of his books that shows that there were three civilizations in Mexico before the present civilization. And each one apparently was destroyed by volcanic activity, followed by tidal waves and inundation. And one of the things that were found by a man named Niven, who did a lot of this work, he was a self-made researcher, and he did a lot of digging in Mexico, I guess it was back in the 20s. And he found heads, little stone or clay statues, and they had all these different races that you're mentioning. And so apparently, before these tremendous obliterations of civilizations, there must have been a tremendous amount of movement around the planet, and particularly around the what we call the Pacific Rim, between societies, Oriental and other societies. You know, so and you know the kinds of things like travels of what was his name, Thor Heyerdahl? Is that I'm pronouncing that right? He's wrong because they didn't get here through boats. Mu was, according to Edgar Cayce, and even according to legends when I lived in Santa Barbara, Mu, the eastern coast of Mu, touched what is now the western coast of the United States. And so these people, you know, there was a lot of trade apparently going on around the world at that time before all these things started going wrong. Incidentally, one thing which I didn't get into, because I don't know enough about geology and I don't want to get into that, but is pertinent about all this, and I recalled it from a little geology course I took when I was in college, is that the central portion of the United States was an inland sea at one time. And much of the North American continent was, you know, marshy. And so people, you know, didn't live here. And I forget from my geology course when the earth changes took place, which brought up the land under the United States Midwest. But apparently when those changes came about and the land came up, there and then and other parts of the United States to make it more solid and livable, apparently that's when the people from Moose started coming to North America.
So this must have been hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Well, I don't know how long it was, because I say I don't remember. I don't remember exactly
geology.
What it was, but
so
my geology.
Well, it just reveals the great age of that civilization of that.
Well, there apparently are other civilizations also, which I didn't get into. The eastern coast of the United States, according to Edgar Cayce and some others, was settled by people who were fleeing Atlantis when it was going down. So your native Indian population in the United States is not the same from the east coast to the west coast. It's a different group of people on the East Coast as from the West Coast. And the reason that there are similarities in their appearances, obviously, is because these people, many thousands of years ago, originally left Mu, went to Atlantis, and then went to the western part of the United States.
Interesting. You know, you brought up William Niven, who did a tremendous amount of archaeological excavation in the 20s. And I've actually seen his books and read one book where he literally has page after page of thousands of special symbols and artifacts, carvings, and figurines by the thousands. And he was never really taken serious for all this finding. And it's amazing because it's... He actually worked for a long time doing his research, didn't he?
Yeah, and the reason for that and for Churchward both is that they didn't have PhDs. They were not professors at some university, and so the academic community just dismissed them.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah.
The most interesting thing, though, with Niven was that in addition to the stuff that you mentioned, he found, I think it was something like 2,600 tablets, and he could make a sense out of them. And so he sent rubbings of these tablets to Churchward, and Churchward told him that apparently these tablets appeared to be the descendants, in terms of symbols, of the symbols he'd found for Mu. So all these tablets in the Mexican clay had been originally the symbols and their meanings and so on had been had come down from Mu. So there's another connection between Mu and in this case and Mexico.
Can you refresh our memory on just where? Because I know it was Central somewhere in Central America or Central Mexico that Niven was digging. But do you remember specifically what areas? I don't have the reference in front of me.
Wait a second. I forget the name because it's a Mexican name. But I think it's here's Mexico. Okay, let me see now. It's I know it's northwest. Okay, here.
It was. I mean, I know for a fact that he found these this evidence in different locations, but there was one place when you brought up the 2600 tablets. That was one specific place that was probably part of a temple, I remember. But
he originally started digging in San Miguel Amantla, mm-hmm. Atzacapotzalco, however you pronounce that. Valley of Mexico, in an area not far from the Pacific Ocean, which accounts for them, you know, having been wiped out by the tidal waves when these things happened. And mm-hmm. then, he found the tablets at Santiago Ahuizoetla, however that's pronounced.
Okay.
And then there is there's another area. I'll keep talking if I can find out what the name of it is. But there was this huge area northwest of Mexico City, and there are pyramids there, and there was a whole city with houses and here it is. It's, mm-hmm. I can't pronounce it. Teotihuacan. Teotihuacan.
Oh,
mm-hmm. Okay, and they have pyramids and so on. Now this is an interesting thing.
Oh, is it
Teotihuacan?
Teotihuacan. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a very famous place. Teotihuacan is where the big pyramids are. That's the
right.
One of the largest in the world.
Now,
what's
interesting about this to me is, and it makes me laugh, is that anthropologists and historians invariably say, well, this city was inexplicably abandoned, and then Tiwanaku was inexplicably abandoned, and then all these temples in South America and Central America were inexplicably abandoned. They weren't abandoned. The people were wiped out by these inundations. It wasn't just a Mu that was inundated, but all of the west coast of South America, Central America, and Mexico were inundated. And so the population there didn't inexplicably leave. They were wiped out by these waves.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about this? Because in your book, you describe the seismic regions around the Pacific area and its volatility and and probably the reason why Mu was destroyed was because of a tectonic shift of a huge scale.
No, I don't know. Actually, according to Churchward, it wasn't a tectonic shift. He said that underneath Mu were what he called huge chambers filled with volcanic gas. Now, these are really humongous chambers. I mean, you know, we can't really conceive as to how huge they were, but they were huge. And then apparently, when the volcanoes around the Pacific Rim, around the Ring of Fire, started erupting over various times, they took with them these gases. And after a while, these chambers, which contained these gases, there was nothing in them. And these gases in the chambers had been holding up the continent of Mu. And when the gases were removed from these chambers, the chambers collapsed and then the whole continent of Mu went down with it. And wow. So that is how that happened. But if you do any kind of research at all, and I didn't do very much, just enough to satisfy myself, there is just something like, I can't remember now, something like 975 volcanoes around the Pacific Rim, which is humongous. And so all of these changes which came about, I would assume, by the cooling of the Earth. As it started to cool, these volcanoes came up, and then I don't know enough about geology to get much further into it. But okay. when the continent of Mu went down, it created other changes. Obviously, one of the changes was the raising of the mountains. If you just think logically, if something big goes down the Pacific Ocean, something has to come up somewhere else. Compensate for it. And this apparently is what happened with North and South America, the West Coast. These mountains came up when Mu went down.
And so that's a big enough continent that they probably would have caused earthquakes and tsunamis to hit the Pacific Rim, Mexico, all the way up into California, today's California. Who knows how far up. And pretty much wipe things out substantially.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You know, as I read your book, George, I'm fascinated and kind of in dismay that these early researchers, their work, Niven and Churchward, were dismissed by the scientists, because Niven's work alone is a history that is not valid, and I don't know what the science world thought about. But you also bring up the strange story of Dr. Javier Cabrera de Guevara and his strange stone carvings. What can you tell us about what he discovered? Because his discoveries are unique too.
They're extraordinary. I just stumbled across them by chance. And nobody's paying any attention to them.
Yeah.
And because, I'll get into what they are in a second, but because of certain laws in Peru about ancient artifacts, the farmer who found most of these was almost prosecuted, because they said, you're not allowed to deal in ancient artifacts. And he almost went to jail, to prison. And so what happened was that the man said, oh, I made them up. I forged them. Well, first of all, there are a total of 15,000 of these things. And the idea that one man is going to individually forge engravings on 15,000 stones is ridiculous. But this is what the Peruvian government settled on. So anyway, these stones were discovered first by some farmer. And he took them to this gentleman, and he bought them from him, and the guy came back with more, and so he kept on buying them from this guy, and eventually he wound up with 11,000 of them, and there are another 4,000 that are apparently in the possession of other people, I don't know who, because that was never mentioned, who else owns these.
So let's just stop for a second, and I want to identify these to our audience. These are known as the famous Inca stones. And
Ica.
Ica stones, pardon me. Why they are unique and why they are not considered true artifacts by the scientific community is that a number of them, a quite large percentage, show dinosaurs, show humans riding on dinosaurs, humans interacting with dinosaurs, and this is just too much for conventional science to deal with, so they are considered a sham. But why don't you tell us a little more about what you discovered in these stones? Go ahead.
These, one of the things that I found very interesting is I don't know if it was him or somebody else sent I think it was four of these stones to a scientific laboratory in Germany, and they were analyzed there, and they the scientist there said these are not forgeries. The grooves in the stones that were engraved into the stones are very ancient, and you can show it by, chemical tests.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the stones, which I have in my book, shows engraved on one rock what the surface of the planet Earth looked like about 13 million years ago. Now, that's enough to make your hair stand on end, because even if these were engraved 10 or 20,000 years ago, how did these people know what the Earth looked like 13 million years ago? So that really, gives you some pause. Mm-hmm. And also, when after the government claimed these are all fakes, a man named Dennis Swift wrote a book, and he noted in his book that priests and chroniclers traveling with the Spanish conquistadors in the 1500s wrote about the strange engraved stones of Ica. So these were not, fraudulent. They existed way back when. And a lot of these stones, I didn't mention it in my book, I forgot to mention it, a lot of these stones were found in graves. And one of the occupations of some people in Peru is to rob graves. And this has been going on for hundreds of years. So they'll find graves, ancient graves, which, you can't even locate unless you know where to look, and they'll dig them up. And in many of these graves, they found these stones. So these go way, way back, and they come from an unknown civilization in an extremely distant past. Now, one of the things I mentioned from a couple of sources in my book is that people who are qualified, according to the establishment, to make pronouncements about geological and archaeological things. I've come to the conclusion that the ruins in South America are of two kind. And one kind is things like with the Inca and others like them, and they say this is of relatively recent origin and reflects a deterioration of a much greater culture that existed before the Incas and these other civilizations which are in the history books. So there are two major, according to these people, there are two major civilizations in both South America, Central America,
wow.
Also, there were three, as I mentioned, with Mexico, there were three inundations along the west coast of South and North America, and so there were three stages. There appear to be of only two distinct civilizations in Peru and areas around there, but there were three waves. And one of the things also that I write about in this, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, and that is the language studies that were made and DNA studies that were made. And both Casey, Edward Casey, and James Churchward said there were three waves of immigrants to North and South America. And the language studies and the DNA studies also show three waves of people. And that's really
wow.
Fascinating. And that is purely scientific. This is not legend. This was developed by people in the last 20 years or so. And that's what got me going, and that's what got me to write this book, because I had no intention of writing a book. I just got interested in the subject because I was studying these shamanic rites, and I was taking this shamanic training. And when I started
Amazing.
Reading this modern stuff, I said, whoa, wait a minute. wait a minute, this is not a legend. I mean, what is this, you know?
And exactly.
This book I've written is very small, but you go and read it, and I mean, there are just dozens and dozens and dozens of pure facts which have been developed by scientists in the last 20 or 30 years. So, I mean, you know, somebody saying that Mu is just a legend, they don't know what they're talking about.
Well, they're not paying attention, and this is what drives me nuts. Now, you just brought up something I think would be something to, if they could verify it, would be wonderful, that the conquistadors in their chronicles actually have records of seeing these Ica stones.
It's in the record. It's in the record.
Yeah.
But I can't.
Well, that
I
right
can't
there,
remember.
That would shut these naysayers down a little bit. I just think it's too mind blowing for them to see pictures of humans standing
well, you
next
know, you
to
know
dinosaurs.
What I, you know what? You know what I'd like to see, and maybe you know somebody. It might be me. Somebody should set up a Kickstarter fund. And create a fund of about a couple of $100,000 and find an adventurous graduate student in anthropology and hand in this information and just say, track this all down and find more along the same lines and write a real academic book of 300-400 pages. Proving that there was something there. Incidentally, I couldn't find it again because I only found a couple of mentions, and it's not in my book. But there have been two or three geologists who said there was a continent in the Pacific Ocean, and they probably lost their jobs as a result of that. But there were two or three people who printed articles saying that they believed there was a continent in the Pacific Ocean. So it's not 100% cover up.
Yeah,
and I think it's a cover. I think it's a cover up.
We hear from a lot of geologists and archaeologists on our program. I think it's just a changing of the guard, and I think the young academics, the young archaeologists that are coming up, and we heard it from Scott Walter, who's a respected geologist and who has his program on American Unearthed, that it's the younger groups that are not going to stand by and keep covering things up. I mean, Scott detailed that in his estimation, the Smithsonian Institute is responsible for some of the greatest cover-ups in our country and continues to be so. I believe that it's Smithsonian and also the National Geographic Society that are not our friends, that are not giving us the truth of our heritage, which probably goes back many, many, many thousands of years in the United States. And then in around the world, the story of the Maya is wrong. If you go down to the Maya, their cities are extremely well constructed, engineered to in many ways much better than a lot of the cities that we have today. So there's a story to tell, and it's just a matter of time before this stuff comes up. And books like yours, Mu, the First Great Civilization, help us to see that it's not all fantasy. That there's some validity.
Well, you know, this is very similar to going back to the nonsensical idea that the Earth is flat. I mean, this is exactly the same sort of thing. And one of the things that occurred to me just very recently is that all of these things are being ignored because it does not comply with the religious history in the Bible. You know, and I know that will be a controversial statement, but it just came to me a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, well, yeah. You know, I mean, the Catholic Church has been suppressing all kinds of information over the centuries, and this is just more of the same.
It is. In the time we have left, George, can you tell us a little bit about what you discovered? Now, you state that in your book that there are remnants of Mu from the Hopi Indians that we heard about. And actually, you actually give reference to the elder Oswald White Bear Fredericks, who believes that his ancestry is extremely old and it comes from Mu. I mean, just to know that—that's a book right there.
Well, he wrote a book.
He wrote
a book, and he dictated it. I think it was something like 1993, and then it was finally published in 2007. It's in the big bibliography at the end of my book.
I'll have to look for that. Yeah, that's something I want to read. But can you tell us a little bit about the references to Southern California, to New Mexico, that had these influences, and maybe the Indian tribes that are descendants?
Yeah, it's going out of my head now what the name of these people are. I'll look it up in a second. But anyway, this one group of Indians in California, Chumash Indians, and they always say that they came from the West. They point to the West. Well, what's west of California? The ocean. And so they claim they came from the West. And they are apparently remnants. Some came when, you know, things started going badly, but apparently some must have come just because it was very close to the eastern edge of Mu, and when people started leaving Mu and going to other parts of the world, the Chumash came to California, and they still are there. They lived in the Los Angeles area and Santa Barbara and up the coast, and it goes all the way up to Oregon. I forget what the name of the Indians are up in Oregon, but all of these people are came along there. So one of the things that is interesting is in their language and in other languages, the word Mu keeps coming up. And so, for example, in Hawaii, the people talk about Lemu, L-E-M-U, who is the king of a great kingdom at the bottom of the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. And all kinds of names are incorporated with the word Mu in both Peru and in Japan. Apparently, Japanese and Quechua, the language that the Karo speak, are very similar. And how the heck is that possible, that a bunch of Indians in South America speak almost the same sort of language as the Japanese do? And so there are these linguistic clues that are also found all around the world. And then there are things like farming, terrace farming are found, all kinds similar ways of terrace farming are found in all over the world. And you can't have people developing the same thing at the same time by accident. I mean, it doesn't happen. Let's be serious about this. Everybody doesn't suddenly invent pyramids. I mean, that's nonsense.
Right.
It had to come from somewhere, and everything that is written about, whether it is DNA, whether it's languages, whether it's geology, whether it's geological history, all of it indicates that it came from the center of the Pacific Ocean. Right now we don't have anything in the center of the Pacific Ocean. Well, very logically, as Sherlock Holmes would point out, once you have eliminated the impossible, whatever is left, however unbelievable, is true. And this is the case with Mu.
Okay.
And that's why I wrote the book, because I mean there was just too much information. I had to go and write it down and let other people read it.
Do you think that the design of the pyramid maybe originated in Mu, and there's just some purpose that we don't understand? Because I think there's some scientists that have done tests on the shape of a pyramid, and it does have certain properties that reflect and capture energy and We've had other people on the program that say that, as an example, the Maya built their pyramids over geologically powerful energy fields called telluric fields, and the pyramids were made to actually enhance those fields. How they were used once they got up into the pyramid is no one has an idea. It's a loss.
Yeah, I've read that too. I haven't read very much. I've just read, you know, maybe some mentions of it in relation to the Great Pyramid of Cheops, where I couldn't understand, you know, it's too technical. But they claimed that this was probably something that generated I'm not going to call it electricity, because apparently it wasn't electricity. It was some other type of energy. And somehow or other, we had lost that energy. And if we could recover it, you can forget about coal and oil and electricity, because this energy is something. And of course, the industries would not like it, because this energy can be made for almost nothing and would cost virtually nothing for the people. So obviously, they're going to suppress it.
Okay, let's get esoteric for a minute. Let's talk about spirituality. You are a deeply spiritual person. You're a shaman, and at the beginning of the program, you said that up until Church Ward's work, there was nothing written until 2000, and you felt that there was some kind of an expansion, a vibration that was permeating people to the point where 2000 and after were these books. Do you think that there's something about that, a vibration, something that is causing people to rethink and revisit Mu and Lemuria?
Yeah, let me start by talking about spirituality. The word spirituality has been co-opted by religion. And I do not feel that spirituality is religion. Religion has co-opted spirituality. The Karo shamans, and from what I understand, all shamans are spiritual people. They're not religious people. They are spiritual people. And I want to split that into two parts. One has to do with a creator and your relationship with the creator and who you are as an individual. I believe, like a great many people, that we are spirits or souls, or whatever you want word you want to use it, who are living in physical bodies for whatever reason we're doing it. Okay, so that's one part of the word spiritual. The other part of the word is the actual things that happen, which people call spiritual. So, for example, you know, life after death, reincarnation, natural healing, energy healing, psychic information, you know, these are all sort of dumped into this basket of spiritual. But these things are really halfway between physical and what I just mentioned about spiritual. These are practical things of the spirit. From a practical point of view, I can do a psychic reading and tell a person something that they did not know. Or I can verify something that a person knew about themselves and I had no way of knowing it. Okay? I can do a shamanic technique like a surgeon, and I can affect a certain healing for that person. Okay? I can move attached spirits of earthbound people that are attached to them. I can move them off this person and move them into the light. That's not really a spiritual thing in the first terms that I mentioned. This has nothing to do with God and my relationship with God and who I am. So these things that I am mentioning have existed for hundreds of thousands of years. There's nothing unique about what I do. It has existed for hundreds of thousands of years, and as a man got I think probably got destroyed when Mu and Atlantis got destroyed. Okay? I don't think it was deliberately suppressed by anybody. It simply got lost because the people who survived Atlantis and Mu had only one thing on their mind. I've got to survive. My right. wife and my kids have got to survive. The heck with all the other stuff. We've got to survive. According to Churchward, cannibalism came about as a result of this. These people were stuck on these peaks of mountains in the middle of the Pacific with no food to eat, no animals, and they had to survive somehow, so they ate each other. This was out of necessity. This was not because these people are, quote, savages. This was sheer necessity, just like the Donner Party in the United States who got trapped in a storm and they ate a couple of people. So these things, a lot of the problems that have come about and a lot of the information that's been suppressed or lost, I should say, have come about because of the destruction of Mu and Atlantis. Now, going back to your question, I was not a religious person. I never belonged to any religion, never practiced any religion. And all of a sudden, in 1978, my younger son was lost at sea, and suddenly I was drawn to all these so-called spiritual techniques and practices and information and so on. At the same time, this was in 1978, at the same time, looking back, in the 1970s, there was an explosion of paperback books on metaphysical things, on various kinds of spiritual practices, and on just spiritual matters, as I defined it earlier. And so Edgar Cayce actually said that the calendar is incorrect, and the 21st century started in 1931. Mm. So we've actually been in the 21st century for 85 years. So this millennium is intended, according to esoteric records, to be a spiritual one. You wouldn't know it by what's going on today, but if you look at what's going on in the world, you'll see that despite all the nasty things that are happening, there are some very positive things that are happening also, especially in the United States. And despite all the things that are wrong still, you know, with certain things in our country, like our race relationship and our economic distribution of wealth, other things have changed definitely for the better.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, we don't have child labor anymore. Women aren't property anymore. Women have the right to vote. Minorities have civil rights. And you have, in-law voting rights, et cetera, et cetera. So there are still things wrong, but if you look at the broad span of this country and of the world, things are more spiritual. They're nowhere near what they should be, but they are more spiritual. Now, one of the things in relation to your original question that I ran across, and I can't give you any more than just a mention because that's all I found. I found a mention somewhere that the navel of the world, the so-called heart chakra of the world, was in Tibet for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Mm. Now, this energy in Tibet was a masculine, intellectual, mental energy. Sometime in the last few years, maybe around 2000, I don't know exactly what the date was, that navel of the world, or that heart chakra in Tibet, moved, and it moved to Peru. And now it is not generating the intellectual male energy. It is generating heart energy and feminine energy. So this is going to cause a tremendous change in the world, and you can see it reflected in the United States by the roles that women are beginning or have been assuming in the last 30, 40 years. You can see the feminine interest. The other thing that I ran across is a legend that when the condor of South America pairs up with the eagle of the United States, then the new millennium will start. Well, the condor is heart-centered. The eagle is intellectually centered. So what this is saying is when we combine our intellect with our heart, then we'll start becoming new people.
Mm.
And one of the things that's involved in my shamanic training and the rites that I got, was that these rites are intended to create a new human being, which Alberto Villoldo calls Homo Illuminus, the illuminated human, the illuminated human. And this is not just, an emotionally or spiritually illuminated person. His belief and mine also, and many others, and you've probably heard this also, is that once we get a certain level of spiritual evolvement of the human race, the entire planet will change its vibratory rate and will become less physical and less material oriented.
Okay.
And I think that legend and Alberto's and these rites of the Caro reflect that.
Amazing. So to my mind, and it's in the Vedas, the ancient Hindu doctrines, and the yugas, is that this is a cyclic situation. We've probably been here, this evolution before, hundreds of thousands of years ago, maybe millions of years ago, and that's really the challenge I see. I used to be very frustrated at our sciences for poo-pooing ancient civilizations because there was no documents, but luckily we do have some ruins. But it's a subtle energy kind of a thing. It's a subtle orientation that we're receiving. We're being bathed with unseen vibrational energy that's changing us. It's evolving us.
Right.
We're not on a level to understand it because we don't have the technology to measure it yet. It's just that we have to see it. We see it in our kids, and we see it in glimmers of hope with what people are doing. But I guess it's a little challenging for a lot of us, including me.
I had one example of what you're talking about. It was really made me sit up and take notice. I had a woman who got me started on my spiritual path, and her name is Marianne Starnes, and she's a minister of a church, but she's also an extraordinary psychic. And she was my first spiritual teacher. And she said, this was back in 1978, she said that the children that are being born at that time, she said, these are extraordinary children. And they will change the world. And I started, said, yeah, okay. And then right around that time, I met this young woman in an Edgar Cayce group and got to be friends with her. And she had two small daughters. I think one was about 3 years old, three and a half years old. One was about six, something like that. And one afternoon, I'd never met them, and one afternoon I went over to, give her something or get something from her to her place, and she went to get a cup of tea for me, and while she was doing that, these two little girls start talking to me, three and six. I'm talking to them for about 5 minutes, and by that time, they were the adult and I was the child. I mean, these two little girls just made my hair stand up. Really, I mean, they were. I can't describe it. All I can say is that they were just they were talking to me on a level that no child talks. Okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't using adult language, but what they were telling me or what they were saying or what they were discussing at 3 and 6, I mean, I have never heard a 3 and 6 year old say before. Mm-hmm. So she said, you know, a lot of people, a lot of very spiritual people, I assume that many of these people had finished their cycle on Earth and are coming back as a service to mankind, are coming back, and a lot of them are have been reincarnating since, you know, mid-70s, and so mid-70s, so that makes them about 35, 40 years old, and so we should start seeing some very interesting things in the next 10, 20 years, because these people are going to take over the world.
Well, those are that would be the age group known as the millennials, and so that group apparently is the up and coming people out here in California, here in the Bay Area. The millennials are the ones who are running the Googles and the Yahoos, a lot of the fantastic startups developing software applications for iPhones and for computers and things like that. But that's pretty hard evidence. There's some subtlety that I'm waiting to see. And so that's good news. That's good news. George, it's been a great honor, and I want to thank you for your contribution, Mu, the first great civilization. And I want to remind people that Dr. George Schwimmer, my guest today, has also written quite a few other books. Psychic awareness, energy work. He's done a lot of and written a lot, and all these books are available as downloadable digital books on Amazon. And I really encourage my audience who is listening to this program to go and download George's books. They're quite well written. They're composed in a situation that if you don't have a Kindle reader, you can use the Amazon readers that are all free, or you can download a reader that allows you to see and read and see the images in George's books without any kind of additional payment or technology needs. Most computers today, if you're at least running Windows 7, even XP, I believe, which is old now, will run a digital file for an ebook. So George, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Is there any new books that you can tell us about that are on the cusp?
Well, I just wrote one book which has nothing to do with spirituality.
Okay.
You want me to mention that?
No, go ahead. That's fine.
It's about Lee Harvey Oswald, the man who was supposedly killed John Kennedy. And I wound up doing the same sort of research that I did for this Mu book. I didn't intend to write a book. It's just I got curious about him one day, and I started reading about him. And it's there is no doubt whatsoever that the Warren Commission was a pack of lies, and that they framed him and that they murdered him. And so I wrote this book, and it's called The Truth Behind the Legend of Lee Harvey Oswald. So that's my latest one. It's okay. The only book I've written that's not spiritual.
Ah, okay. Fantastic. Well, thanks again. And again, you can find all George's books on Amazon. They're all digital e-books. And perhaps, as you say, we are all slowly becoming homo illuminous beings. I think it's something to consider. Be nice to have some technology to be able to measure that. So thanks again, George.
Thank you.
So that's our program today. I want to remind you that next week the guest is going to be speaking on DMT, and I hope you'll join us. Also, please go to Facebook and see each week. Facebook Earth Ancients has a great list of items that are not only of my interest, that are of interest to our community. And if you go to Facebook and you go to Earth Ancients, you go to the group page, that has more blogging, it has my blogs, has my articles, has my information. But we have over 12,000 members, and I encourage people to write and provide their focal points too on what interests them. Again, happy 4th of July, and we'll talk to you next week.